Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Busy show coming up today, Cherry Gregg. Our big topic this hour starts with a question. Have you investigated your family tree or used one of those at-home ancestry kits? Americans are spending billions of dollars digging into their roots, but widespread commercial DNA tests bring up lots of other issues. We'll hear from Libby Copeland, who wrote The Lost Family, how DNA testing is upending who we are.
Interesting. We're also talking about spicy food, my favorite, later in the hour. And I love it. You love it. But some people don't. We're going to get into the science behind our different taste preferences and how you can actually train your palate to have a higher tolerance for spice. Before we get to that, though, it's Juneteenth today, the holiday that marks the end of slavery in America, a landmark day in Black history.
There was so much hope in 2020 that when the Black Lives Matter movement expanded after the murder of George Floyd, it would rectify some of the ongoing racial injustices in America, from inequities in the education system to the criminal justice system. But our next guest says those efforts to right racial wrongs have not panned out. In fact, there's been a powerful backlash.
CNN analyst Bakari Sellers' new book explores why the promise of a racial reckoning never materialized and offers a prescription for realizing political and social justice for Black people. Sellers is also an attorney and was a state representative in South Carolina, making history as the youngest member of the South Carolina state legislature at just 22 years old. He joined us to talk about the moment. Thoughts on the race reckoning that wasn't, and how we all can move forward now.
I start the book with a couple of images, and the one that's probably the most profound, which is where we got the name from, was when I was on air, and I was actually on with Dante Stallworth. This was after George Floyd was murdered, and in the segment before me was Felonious Floyd, George's brother, and Ben Crump. And I was this is back in the time when we were still in our homes. I was doing TV from my dining room table with my pajama pants on and my suit jacket. And my hair was scruffy. Don Lemon says I look like a young Teddy Pendergrass. And my twins were in my bed with my wife and I. And I was, went up and went to the kitchen. And then my daughter was upstairs. And in that moment, you could hear the pain of Felonious Floyd. You could hear him articulate what he was going through. And the question was asked of me, you know, what do you do in this moment, particularly for Black children? And I became really emotional thinking about what that pain was and how it felt to be Black in America at that particular time. And I began to cry on air. And it was one of those moments that kind of cut through a lot of the noise. And I think it resonated with people and spoke to people. It was also a moment then where we realized that we could have been on the precipice of change. But I think that many people will see, if you're intellectually honest, you'll see that that change we were hoping for did not materialize. And even worse, it's a legitimate argument to say that we've regressed.
Yeah. So what is that argument? I mean, what did you hope was going to happen in that moment? And what didn't happen?
So I guess maybe it's my youthful naivete, because although I'm not still 22, I'm only 39. And I think I was hopeful that we would begin to have conversations about how to dismantle these systems of injustice that we have in our country. I mean, we can have a whole show on criminal justice, but that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. That's just a part of it. I'm talking about the environmental injustices that we see. I'm talking about the injustices and inequities we see in our healthcare delivery system. For example, Black women are still three times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. I'm talking about a lack of access to capital. I'm talking about a miseducation of our children. I'm talking about an infrastructure system which disproportionately affects poor people and brown people in this country. And so we just simply did not have those conversations. There were a lot of promises made. Many of the promises were kept in regards to dollars going to this program or dollars going to that program. But these systems did not get dealt with. They're still in place today. They're stronger than they ever have been. And then we've seen some steps taken, whether or not it's affirmative action or whether or not it's abortion ban from the 1800s in Arizona, or whether or not it's the efforts to, kind of bastardize the word woke and eliminate DEI. We've seen the efforts on college campuses now to eliminate scholarships for Black folk, attacks on the Fearless Fund. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. But even more importantly, I think that we've seen a manifestation of racism become more outward. We're all old enough, although this is the youngest interview cohort that I've seen in a very long time, we're all young enough to remember when racists stayed inside. or they were in the shadows. Mm-hmm. And now I make the argument that we've taken away the white hoods and sheets with the eyes cut out, and now they have Brooke Brothers suits and their own, you know, travel talk radio shows or primetime spots on cable news.
So what do you attribute that?
A monetization of racism. I think what we've seen is there's been an inherent value placed on that. You know, we call out the names in the book. We talk about Tucker. We talk about Sean Hannity. We talk mm-hmm. about Clay Travis. We talk about all of these individuals because right now there is a value that's been placed on that. It's been monetized. And so that's why it's been able to find a place and a home in society. No further than I'm sure both of you guys have X accounts. And I'm sure that if you just objectively looked at your X account, that you have seen what has been a consistent rise in anti-Semitism, racism on your Twitter feed since you started this probably back in 2010 or 2012.
And by the way, you come from a activist family, and we'll talk about your dad a little bit and his influence on you in a moment. But you kind of say that one of the big issues was the black church.
Mm.
And it changed over the years.
I'm still trying to get people to buy the book now. Don't be having a mad.
No. But I want you to make that, you know, just, and we're not going to give all the spoilers, but that was a big issue. And I was like, wow, that was fascinating that you saw this change in the black church.
You know, my father was one of the founding members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the black church during the 40s, 50s, and 60s was more than a place for spiritual nourishment. It was a place in which individuals went to organize. It was a place in which individuals went to mobilize. It was a place in our community which held a position of change, right? It was a forward-thinking place of change. I mean, the conversations that were being had, I think, immediately to Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail. He was writing that letter to other black folk, particularly other black ministers, right? But it was just this bastion of an exchange of ideas. And I think now I don't want I know I'm generalizing, and I do that purposefully because I want the dialogue to be decently provocative. I want people to want to be engaged in this conversation. I know the work the AME Church does. I know that there are probably mm-hmm. some select churches that do. But for a whole or on a whole, one of the things that we've seen a lot like racism, we've seen capitalism kind of permeate throughout the doors of the black church, where now there's a question of how many likes can we get, or how good can our musical selections be, or how big can our church be?
The ATMs in the back of the church.
You know,
I've seen that
before. I'm cool with all of that, right? Mm-hmm. If you do the work. And that's the thing. You have to be able to do that work, not just on Sunday morning, but you have to be willing to do that work Monday through Saturday as well. You know, it's no reason to say that you have the largest church here or whatever it may be if you're not offering mammograms, if you're not making sure the kids have an opportunity to come to your school to learn, if you're not organizing, mobilizing, gassing up church vans, making sure they're voting in local elections. All of those things are necessary. And that's what the black church was. The question is, what will the black church be? Because right now it ain't that.
But don't you also argue that the messaging has changed? There's this focus on prosperity preaching.
Of course.
And for someone who's not familiar, I mean, explain what that is and how you feel it runs counter to the spirit of the black church from prior generations.
Yeah. You know, prosperity preaching, I think for those who do not understand what it is, I would point you directly to Joel Osteen. That's the best example I can give you. Mm-hmm. Right. That's a newer phenomenon where you literally can get in the pulpit and you've seen the clips, I'm sure, on Snapchat or TikTok, and people tell you about how big their plane is, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is getting to the root of making sure that black folk not only can survive, but thrive, right? And what that means is we have to get beyond this kind of prosperity gospel and begin to talk about how we're going to destroy systems of oppression and rebuild them in an image that looks like us.
One of the interesting things is you were raised, your dad, Cleve Sellers, mm-hmm. Was a well-known civil rights activist, worked alongside John Lewis, all the greats during that era, and almost died in a racial massacre in 1968. Tell us about your dad and what it was like sort of growing up in the shadow of someone who was in it, like all the way in the movement. Yeah.
So I tell people that I'm a product of the proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. My village was so dope, though. Because, like, you know, Uncle Jesse and who's Jesse Jackson and Julian Bond is like my hero. I love Uncle Julian. May he rest in power. And, you know, Marion Barry and Kathleen Cleaver used to call, and Judy Richardson, and all of these people whose shoulders I stand upon. And when I write my books, this is my second one that I've written, I like to tell stories about them so that their plight can be illuminated as well. In fact, in the introduction, I start with an image of my dad and John Lewis and Jim Foreman, and they are they've just been arrested, and they were being bonded out by Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. And it's a unique picture because it's this intersection of kind of black wealth, black popular culture, black entertainment, and grassroots activism, and how they came together to kind of put their shoulder to the wheel to get us out this ditch. And me and my father begin to have this conversation about kind of where we are. My dad, February 8, 1968, was shot by South Carolina state troopers along with 28 others. Three young men were killed, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and Delano Middleton. They actually tried my father. They tried all the officers who fired shots. They were found not guilty, but they tried my father, and they convicted him of rioting. He became the first and only one-man riot in the history of this country. And so my dad went to jail not once but twice. He went to jail the first time for refusing to go to Vietnam. He went to jail the second time for the Orangeburg Massacre. And so I feel as if I have a unique opportunity, obligation, and the right to challenge this country and make her better, because the blood of my family literally runs through the soil of this great country. Yeah.
Your father also seems, from what I read in this book, to be pretty pessimistic about where we are
right
now.
I know. He seems like an ornery old man.
No, but you say he's a gentle guy in disposition, but that his opinions are, you know, sort of pessimistic about where we are, which is kind of shocking to read for someone who has lived in such difficult times and lived through such horrific violence. You didn't even mention that he was involved in what happened in Philadelphia, Mississippi, three civil rights activists murdered.
He searched for the
So bodies. Someone who has seen that and lived that, to be pessimistic about why we are now, it's tough to read. Yeah. Can you explain his pessimism?
Yeah, I don't agree with it, right? Yeah. Which is the funniest part of our conversation. By certain metrics, he's right? Mm-hmm. Tangible metrics, like black home ownership today is the same as it was in 1968. Those are tangible metrics to say.
I can tell y'all have this debate quite often.
Those are tangible metrics to say, like, look, our progress is not where it should be. But I refuse to acknowledge that point that he makes, because I think about Henry Smith and Samuel Hammond and Delano Middleton. I think about Emmett and Medgar and Jimmie Lee Jackson. I think about those individuals who gave what Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion. And there are so many people who were shot and killed and know what jailhouse floors feel like, who sacrificed so much. And my problem with that sentiment of my father and many others, I was in a conversation with April Ryan recently in Baltimore on my book stop. She maintains the same position. But my problem with that is that if you take that position, are you saying that the work that they did and the blood that they shed and the lives that were given were done in vain? And I refuse to take that position.
So what's your counter argument, though, that some progress has been made?
My argument is simply this, that in this country, we've made a great deal of progress, but we still have yet a ways to go.
We only have a few more minutes, but I have to talk about your chapter titled The Untapped Power of Black Men. I really think you should expand that to a full book. It was fascinating discussion there. And one of the things that you talk about is you argue that Democrats have failed to take the power of black men seriously, which has led to the erosion of the black male vote. Talk about that and what needs to change.
Yeah, for a long period of time, we've only given black women their flowers, which they deserve them. But we have not paid attention to the plight or listened to the plight of black men and the pain and the struggle that they're going through to make ends meet, to survive, to go through the trauma of what it is to live that experience in this country. That chapter was meant to be a clarion call, like the, you know, how you get in your car and the blinking lights are on and saying, look, we don't have an emergency yet, but we may in the future. Black men are the second largest demographic voting base for the Democratic Party, behind only black women. They don't get treated as such. They don't. My argument is that we need to meet black men where they are, and we need to begin to have conversations where those conversations don't start with us trying to yell or articulate what we believe they should do. But it's also to give them their flowers and listen to them and the pain that they see and they feel that they're going through right now.
And you argue also that this has left the door open for white right wing activists, media to jump in and get a stronghold. Yeah. We see 19%.
I don't believe the numbers are going to be that high, but, you know,
voting Republican.
Yeah, yeah. I don't believe the numbers are going to be that high, but I'll tell you something even more dangerous, that I don't believe this election to be between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. I think that's a terrible analysis that people fall victim to. I think this election is between Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and the couch. And I think in particular with black men, the couch will be highly successful if we do not begin to pay attention to them. The couch is one of the most amazing candidates we've ever seen because it don't run no ads, but continuously people begin to take that option other than the other two.
And what does paying attention to them look like?
Actually listening to them, having them involved in those conversations, having conversations not just in a barbershop, but making sure that we're meeting them on the front lines, talking and messaging to working class black men. Joe Biden's going to be at Morehouse College, my alma mater, coming up soon for graduation. And when asked what should he talk about, I said Joe Biden should talk about peace globally. It feels like the world's on fire. He should talk about abortion and the role that black men can play in preserving our head of household and making sure that our wives and daughters can make decisions for their own bodies. I said he should talk about voting rights, and he should talk about a black agenda and student loan forgiveness. But if he gets on stage and talks about criminal justice reform for 25 minutes, I will personally riot because black men care more than just about that.
So they feel they've been typecast.
Typecast, stereotyped by the people who we support the most.
Yeah. And you also mentioned of black men, they say the Democrats are not fighting enough. Now, that's a paraphrase of a longer quote, but I that struck me, not fighting enough. Is it something attitudinal about the way the Democratic Party presents itself?
Yeah, it's an attitudinal type of thing. I mean, a lot of the, to what you're saying, a lot of the gravitating towards the Donald Trumps of the world is simply because of the presentation of some kind of
is it a machismo type?
It's a machismo. That's a great word. And it just shows that somebody's fighting for you, will fight for you, has the toughness to win a battle for you.
Wow. And you mentioned a couple of commentators that you don't agree with, but that you believe have captured the attention of black men. I think he's mentioned Ice Cube and Stephen A. Smith in the book.
Yeah.
Is that the appeal there?
No, I think that that's anti-intellectualism. Okay. I've had a long discussion about Stephen A. Smith.
That's a separate thing.
Just recently on The Breakfast Club, I think that he appreciates being white adjacent. And so he utilizes his platform to prop up those individuals like Tucker and like Sean Hannity.
Carlson,
and Sean Hannity and others. And I think that he does a great disservice to our community. But that, I do mention those people in the book as black men who are individuals who we have to hold accountable as well.
Bakari Sellers is a CNN political analyst and attorney and the author of The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We All Can Move Forward Now.
Coming up, Americans love mail-in DNA test kits that promise to track down relatives and pin our family origins around the globe. But what about data privacy and even the possibility of uncovering dark generational secrets? We're talking about finding our roots coming up.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Cherry, I know you remember this.
Mm-hmm.
Months ago, we did a show about television history, unrelated topic, and a listener named Keith Mason called in to tell us about how he found his long-lost father.
I found my father for the first time walking, talking as a contestant on To Tell the Truth, October 1961.
Two of these people are imposters. Only one of them is the real Ladislaus Fargo and is the only one sworn to tell the truth.
I found out about his sociopathic life, 7 marriages, 6 wives, 8 other siblings. My grandfather was a reporter murdered by a dirty cop in Texas in 49.
That call still gives me goosebumps. That was crazy. That was so crazy. Now, most family histories, Avi, are not that dramatic, but afterward, Keith said, why don't you do a show about all the unusual ways people have discovered new family? Millions of people these days are finding their roots with DNA testing, ancestry websites, and more. It's as popular as gardening.
And we said, Keith, you're right. This is a fascinating topic.
Today, we have more ways to dig into our own past. So what are we learning? And what do we want to know? Our next guest has some answers. Her name is Libby Copeland. She is a freelance writer and the author of The Lost Family, How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are. Libby joins us today to talk about our American obsession with family history. Libby, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, thanks so much.
Libby, I want to start here and just talk about the industry of DNA test kits and websites like Ancestry.com.
Our expansive record collections and growing network of family trees have helped our members make billions of meaningful connections. Those are more than names and dates. They're relatives, homes, hardships, and triumphs that all become part of the rich stories we share.
When did this stuff first emerge onto the scene, and what has its growth been like over the last 5-10 years?
Yeah, I mean, in a word, meteoric. This is an industry that's been around since about 2000, if you looked at it back then, you wouldn't recognize it as the same thing that exists today. The bulk of the growth has really taken place over the last 10 to 12 years, and that's been because of technological developments that have made it easier for companies to tell you about your recent genetic past and connect you with relatives who have tested in the same database whose names you might not know, but it turns out that that's a second cousin once removed. Mm-hmm. And as the databases have grown larger and the companies have gotten better, the databases have also grown, and companies have put a lot of money into advertising. And we are at over 40 million folks who've taken what they call a recreational DNA test kit. And most of those folks are in the United States.
It's like a snowball effect. The more people that use it, the more interesting the tool becomes. It's so fascinating. Go ahead, Cherry.
And so, Libby, got to ask you, for folks who may not know, how does the DNA testing typically work, and what types of information does it provide you with access to?
Sure. So depending on the company that you go with, you're either spitting into a tube or you're swabbing your cheek with something that looks a little like a Q-tip, and then you're sending it away to the company. And the company is doing some analysis, which could take some weeks. And when they get back to you, there's two key pieces of information that they're giving you. One is a sense of where your ancestors came from on both sides of your family, all the branches, anywhere between 500 and 1,000 years ago. So if you're like me, you'll have a lot of different places lighting up on the map for where you came from. And then the other piece of it is folks who are related to you in the database. So other consumers who actually have matching genetic segments. And that's where a lot of the really interesting breakthroughs and revelations, surprises come in, because you wind up seeing who your closest relatives are, in this long list.
I want to bring in a comment here from Eunice, who says, I am totally obsessed and have such rich, interesting stories on each side of my family. I often share my findings on social media. The lineage of my paternal family history from Mississippi was detailed in a 2016 feature film called The Free State of Jones. Matthew McConaughey portrayed my fourth great-grandfather.
Every man's a man. You can walk on two legs. You're a man. From this day forward, we declare the land north of the Pascagoula Swamps, south of Enterprise, and east of the Pearl River to the Alabama border to be a free state of Jones.
Wow.
So I'll lead that into a question, Libby Copeland. Why are we so drawn to these stories? Why are these products so popular?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the particular DNA of Americans, if you will. A lot of Americans did come from someplace else. Unless you're Indigenous American, you know, there was some point in time when your ancestors came over. The powers of assimilation, especially during the course of the 20th century, meant that a lot of Americans, and particularly white Americans, there's been sort of work looking at this, shed their cultural practices, their religion, their language, their foods, and to become more quote unquote American. Mm. And so what you have now is a lot of Americans kind of looking up and saying, I don't actually know where my great grandparents came from. I don't even know my grandparents, I don't know their names. There's such a sense of disconnection. So you see people kind of wanting to understand that. There's a search for, authenticity might be the word. This idea that you're not just American, you're also this, right? Yep. Wanting to connect with your roots.
And we have a caller on the line right now. Sue hails from Princeton. who says you should think through testing. Sue, you have a story. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. Interesting topic. So my husband was contacted by his half-brother, who learned about my husband through DNA testing. It was the half-brother who did the testing. And so then my husband was like, well, what? That's weird. Should I talk to my father about this? His mother had since passed away. And his father was in his 90s. And we talked about it. We decided no. If his father had wanted him to know, his father would have told him.
Yep.
And so we decided to tell the half-brother, we are not going to connect with you until the father passes away. And that's after so the father passes away, then you make the connection. And it was an interesting connection. But I'm just saying, think it through before you think, oh, this person's going to be so excited to learn about me.
That's such an interesting perspective.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue, for that story. And that leads to my other question, sort of, what should you be thinking about when you, because I've been really nervous about doing one of these, and I have not done it. And so I want you to kind of walk us through some of the thought process that and the considerations before you just send your DNA off and the psychological aspects of it, like Sue was talking about.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that call was such a poignant example of the sort of logistics and the emotional considerations that take place. In my book, The Lost Family, I spent a lot of time sort of talking to people about how they became their own, basically their own bioethicists, right? You're in a situation that is completely new to your family. It's never happened before. And you have to make a decision about what is the ethical thing to do. Do you tell your mom, for instance, that she was donor conceived and she doesn't know it? Right? That she's actually not related to the man she thinks of as her father. Mm. What is the burden of information on you? And how does it implicate often older generations that, you know, made decisions about what to reveal and what to conceal based on stigmas and taboos that may not be as culturally relevant right now, but they are still very strong. Those emotions accompanying certain secrets are very strong. So, you know, shame, guilt, embarrassment, you know, there are people, for instance, who placed their child for adoption and never told their husbands or their children after they went on to have a family, right? And that omission may be central to keeping that marriage intact, right? Because imagine the sense of betrayal that husband and children could feel if they learned something about their mother that she never told them. Not that the act itself was bad, but the failure to tell, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we're learning in this moment is just the impact of family secrets and how much delicacy and care and compassion we have to bring, particularly with these intergenerational you know, conversation. So, yeah, I mean, I think the thing I tell people is there's no way to know what you're going to discover before you test. And once you learn it, you can't undo it.
Yep.
So make sure you're in a place where you're sort of ready to open that box and know that it may not be something that necessarily impacts you, but it could be really impactful for a sibling. For instance, you find out your sibling is a half sibling and their father is someone else, right? Yep. There's so many situations like this where we don't realize how interconnected our lives are and how much we depend on each other and how, you know, how many complications there can be until you sort of take technology and, you know, use it to examine the past.
Yeah, we're kicking open some doors that our ancestors wanted to keep closed.
Yes.
I want to bring in, you mentioned adoption. I wanted to bring in a caller now. This is Beth on line one who has a story about this very thing. Beth, what's your question or comment? You're on Studio Two.
Hi. So I've been doing Ancestry for a long time to do, just to keep track of like family tree, genealogy and stuff. I was adopted as an infant and I was doing, you know, my adopted family, my family's genealogy and everything. And for fun, when my husband did his DNA, I did mine just for fun. And I did not open my matches just for that reason. You can do your DNA, you know, kind of see the fun little map of where your DNA is from and all that, but without opening matches because I feel like it's not my place.
Yeah.
My birth mother is probably in like her early 60s. It's not my place to like blow up her life, possibly her children's lives, you know, her family's life. So I just never opened that up, you know, and that's an option.
It is
that's
a Pandora's box.
I mean, that's amazing, though, that you have that information, Beth, and you've made the choice there to put it to the side. And I'm curious, bringing back in Libby Copeland now, how is this technology, how can it be used by people to connect with biological parents if they were adopted or perhaps were conceived through sperm donors or egg donors? How is this technology possibly used to reveal some of those connections?
Yeah, this has been one of the most transformative pieces of how DNA, recreational DNA testing is playing out. Just 10, 15 years ago, if you, for instance, had been adopted and the adoption was closed and you live in a state where you can't access your original birth certificate, so you don't know the names of your birth parents, you might need to hire a private investigator to in an attempt to find your birth parents if you wanted to identify them and maybe connect with them before they passed. And even then, you could pay a great deal of money and work on that for a decade and never succeed. Mm. And now people are finding out sometimes in as little as days and even hours, because they take a test, they get their results, and they see right away, oh my goodness, there's a half sister just sitting at the top of my match list. So basically, you know, there's a sort of political and civil rights debate around whether adoptees should be able to access their original birth certificates. And that's a separate thing. But in many ways, DNA testing has effectively allowed people to make an end run around that and discover that information in some ways make that question of the birth certificate almost like running to catch up with where the technology is taking us. With the matter of sperm donation, there's no such thing as an anonymous sperm donor anymore. That simply doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you donated your sperm in 1975 25 times, as you know, a man I interviewed spoke with and you know was promised anonymity, and you know, he has now 23 children that he knows of. You know, some of them come to Thanksgiving. Like it doesn't matter what contracts were signed, because they're moot.
That is amazing. Oh my gosh.
I want to zoom out a bit, and that is because you go into this,
yeah,
it's mind-blowing there, but I want to shift a bit and zoom out a bit, because one of the things that I think makes people a little bit nervous taking these DNA tests is that you could pull out something very painful from your past, especially I'm an African-American woman. I think about slavery and opening that Pandora's box. And I want to play this clip in season two of this episode of Finding Your Roots. Rapper Nas encounters a bill of sale for his enslaved ancestor. And I want you to take a listen to that.
This is the bill of sale for your third great grandmother.
A receipt for a human being. $830. They paid $830 for my great-great-great-grandma? I got more than that in my pocket right now. See, this is painful now. This is like, to see that, it's like, that hurts.
Take a look at that guy. That is the white man who owned your ancestors.
This is the face my ancestors looked at every day.
Every day.
The eyes they looked at. Now I'm looking into their world, what they saw.
Unfortunately, the house burned down in 1963, and today it's nothing but a forest.
No, I'm just thinking about buying that land.
Oh, good. I was hoping you'd say it.
You know, there's sort of a push and pull here, right? Which is that sometimes connecting to the broader national history can help us make sense of our own lives, but the downside is that it can be very painful. How are people dealing with these discoveries?
Yeah, incredibly painful. I mean, and I think especially for certain, you know, groups like African Americans, for whom it is so difficult to trace your family history in the paper records, because if you descended from people who were enslaved, if you're looking at, say, the federal census before 1870, you're trying to trace an ancestor, that person disappears when they're in enslavement because they become a tick mark in a box. In other words, they're not named, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you follow the journey of a family when those people are not even named? And you know, they're often broken up. children are taking the names of their enslavers. So it's incredibly difficult to trace. And I spent a good deal of time interviewing genealogists from African-American community and other communities that are marginalized or have less good records about the yin-yang, the push-pull of this, right? The desire to know the truth and the truth about history, right? To look at it full in the face and say, this is truly what happened. This is my America, right? This is my story of America. And also this sense of, you know, wanting to also shield yourself from not really truly not knowing what you're going to find, right? Like there's a sense of wanting to kind of protect yourself, at least until you have the stamina and the emotional energy to kind of manage it. And not everyone wants to dig into their genealogy. And that's totally valid. You know, there was a lot of African-American genealogists I interviewed who said DNA testing transformed my capacity to understand the past. Mm-hmm. You know, I that was able to trace back even to a particular region in a particular country in Africa to a particular people that I came from and connect up with a present day cousin. So that, I mean, that's absolutely amazing. But then there were others who said, you know, for privacy reasons, for a whole host of reasons, I don't even want to go there. You know, I'll stick with paper record and talking to family members.
Mm. Yeah. And you mentioned the word privacy. Yep. We have an email from Rob who said 23andMe admitted hackers access DNA data of 7 million users. Another reason not to send your DNA out. I want you to talk about some of the broader implications of handing over your DNA to some of these companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I first started reporting this, it was 2017 and it all seemed quite theoretical.
Yeah.
And it's not anymore.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's issues with hacks. There's issues with questions around what would happen if even genetic information becomes public. I mean, it's not just your genetic information that's sensitive in there. It's also your name, right? And where you come from and who you're related to, all that stuff. And then there's also implications involving law enforcement access in the course of trying to solve cases. Some of the databases have made it themselves accessible to law enforcement for solving cold cases. So there's all these questions around, you know, where to draw the line. And as somebody who is in three databases now, I think about that a lot. I was sort of somewhat hesitant to test in the beginning, but you know, both my parents were already in there and my brother, and I thought, all right, well, our DNA is already out there.
I'm already in there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the question is, if you don't know what the future is going to bring, like we don't know what we don't know. We don't know how this could be used. We don't know how it could be leaked. We don't know how potentially, a bad actor or a foreign country, for instance, or, you know, somebody could get a hold of that information and it could be catastrophic. But at the same time, there's this lure to the magic of being able to, as I see it, crack open your cells and read the past. And I think that's that calculation. Not everyone's going to draw it in the same place. But for me, it came down on the side of deep, deep curiosity and wanting to know. But that's not to say that I may not regret that decision that I and 40 million other people have made,
totally.
You know, to kind of open ourselves up to what we can't imagine.
That was Libby Copeland. She's a writer and author of the book, The Lost Family, How DNA Testing is Upending Who We Are.
Coming up next, on a scale of 1 to 10, how spicy do you like your food? We're digging into the science behind our tolerance for heat.
There's so much you have to know. Find a girl, settle down. If you want, you can marry. Look at me, I am old. But I'm happy. I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on. But take your time, think a lot. Why, think of everything you've got, for you will still be here tomorrow. But your dreams may not.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome on back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arid. Cherry, we've established that you like spicy food. What is your favorite spicy food?
Anything. I love Jamaican food.
And okay.
You can spice
jerk
that up.
Jerk
chicken type food. I also like Indian food. You could turn it up. But I don't like it to be like hot, hot, burn your mouth hot. But I like it to be spicy, flavorful. How about you?
I really like the Szechuan peppercorn type of spice.
You it's
like
do
a,
have.
Is that like a numbing kind of sensation?
A numbing.
Maybe we'll ask our next guest
about
it.
I don't
know how to describe it exactly, but there's something different about that type of spice. We're going to pepper our next guest with some questions. You like that?
I do.
He says, if you can tell if someone likes it hot by their personality. Now, maybe that's not totally surprising that thrill seekers would also like hot chilies, but why do they like it? Why does the capsaicin, what does that capsaicin do to our sensations that makes us crave it and others avoid it? And can anyone just build up a tolerance to heat?
John Hayes is a food science professor at Penn State, where he studies the chemical and sensory experience of food, particularly hot food. He joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Studio 2, John.
Thanks for having me.
John Hayes, I wanted to ask you first, what's the biological response in our body when spicy food hits our mouth? And how does that differ from, how is it from just regular taste?
Right. So that's a great question. We have a receptor in our tongue and in our throat and actually all over our body that's called TRPV1. And this receptor actually just earned David Julius the Nobel Prize a couple years ago for work discovering it. It's a molecular thermometer that we use to sense heat pain. And so evolutionarily, this exists to allow us to pick up noxious, painful heat. Well, somewhere along the way in evolution, the chili plant figured out how to hijack this receptor by making the capsaicin molecule that fits in that thermostat, and it turns the thermostat down. So now at non-painful temperatures, your body gets a signal that says, ouch, that's hot. Most species avoid that and don't want to eat that chili plant, but humans are sort of unique in that we actually seek it out.
Why? That's the part that blows my mind,
question.
John Hayes. I don't understand. This is a defense mechanism, right, that these plants have developed, and yet we still want to, or at least we tolerate in at some level capsaicin. I don't get that. Why?
Right. So, you know, I think that if we look really broadly across lots of plants, they actually evolve these chemicals to prevent things from eating them, right? The nicotine in the tobacco plant is there as an insecticide, and yet we figured out if we smoke it, that makes us feel good, or various other substances that we ingest. You know, we can't set up a controlled experiment to figure out why, so we can just speculate about it. One of the arguments that's been put forth is this idea that when you have a bland, monotonous diet, having something that makes it a little more exciting was probably a good idea. Or if you have a bland, starchy diet, something that makes you salivate more might have made it a bit more palatable.
Mm-hmm.
And personality, right? Here in the United States, spicy food is now ubiquitously available, but it's not ubiquitously consumed. I can reach for that bottle of Sriracha if I want it, but somebody else might not want it. And so we've shown, and others have shown, that this is actually related to personality traits like risk-taking and thrill-seeking.
We have an email from Greg, a native Californian who grew up eating spicy ethnic foods and enjoys them the way natives do. When Greg eats out, he asks to tell the chef to prepare it as if he would for himself at home, and he promises not to send it back. He thinks it isn't just heat, it's complexity. It's like fine wine. And I want to, I did not have that type of complexity early on in life. I did not like spicy food. In fact, I avoided it. But a lot of my friends were from the Caribbean, and so I developed this love for spicy food. How do you sort of shift your palate from a person who can't stand it to now a person who craves it?
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember that our food tastes change across our lifespan, right? When we're young children, we like things that are really sweet. And we know with puberty that our liking for sweetness tends to go down. And then, you know, your typical 18 or 19 year old is not going to like that big, bold Cabernet. And along the way, they're going to, with some lived experience, both get some social reward from sitting around with your friends and talking about wine and enjoying that nuance. Well, chilies are exactly the same way. Some of us grow up eating it, some of us don't, and some of us learn to like it. I didn't grow up eating particularly spicy food, and I'm a big chili head now myself.
Chili head. I like that.
Yeah.
That's an official label, I assume. I want to ask about countering spice after we perhaps ingest a little too much of it. John, what do you think? I know milk is supposed to work. It seems like water doesn't work. What does the research say putting out the flames?
Well, milk, certainly the folklore tells us milk works the best. And actually controlled experiments also show us that whole milk really does seem to work really well. It's cold. It's got a little bit of fat in there. But the classic argument has always been that that capsaicin molecule is highly lipophilic, which means it's fat-liking. It doesn't like water. And so the thought was, well, it's the fat in the whole milk that helps. But there's some data out there that says skim milk actually works just as well as whole milk, which doesn't really make sense if it's the fat. So we've been poking at this idea that maybe it's some of the protein in milk. And we actually just published a paper at the end of last year showing that soy milk that's high in protein also cuts the burn, or that things like ultra-filtered high-protein milk actually cuts the burn even better than conventional whole milk. And so it's probably some combination of that, the fat and the protein that are both scavenging that capsaicin and pulling it away from the receptor that helps you clean up a little faster.
And are there upsides and downsides to spicy food? Like, is there some benefit to eating it or some issues that it can cause from eating spicy food? Yeah.
Right. So if you have spicy food can slow you down. And that could potentially be a good thing if you're trying, like many of us today, to watch what we eat and you want to eat a little less. We know that eating speed affects how much you eat. So if it slows you down a little bit, maybe you give your body time to catch up with some of those satiety signals and maybe not eat so much at the meal. Or there is some evidence in some people that taking even pills with chili powder might seem to help with speed your metabolism up a little bit. But on the flip side, of course, if you eat it really, really hot, like I like to have those tears streaming down my face. And when really good Korean food makes my nose run and I have to blow my nose through the whole meal, I'm actually in heaven. But the next day, it's not so pleasant. And so, there can be those downsides as well.
So GI distress, that is actually provably a result of sometimes eating too much spicy food?
100%. There's an old Hungarian proverb that says, good paprika burns twice.
Wow. And I can imagine if you have...
Yeah. I'm not going to elaborate on that. John Hayes, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks so much.
John Hayes is a professor of food science and the director of the Sensory Evaluation Center at Penn State University. I think it's time to go eat some spicy food. What do you think? Let's do it.
I'm going to keep it bland today.
Oh, bland,
that's it
boring.
For Studio 2 today. Be sure to follow WHYY on all social platforms. Download us wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's program from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfmaneri.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much, friends, for joining us.